Hello Pod Squad. Our live recording on the 20th of March is now available for booking. We are super excited about this. Fiona and I will be at the Wanstead Tap in East London at 7:30 on the 20th of March with our guest, the author Leo Hollis, to talk all things Mary Davis. You can find the link to our tickets on our website and on our social media. You'll need a password to access it at the start, which is London20, although shortly it will be going to just open public sale. So if you want to get in there quick and come and join us on the 20th of March, we would love to see you. Go and find the Eventbrite link on our website.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the podcast that takes a light-hearted look at lesser-known London stories with your own personal blue badge professional tourist guides.
She's Fiona.
And she's Alex.
And this is the Ladies Who London podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome, welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Fi.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm sorry.
I haven't been at the house much today. I'm a bit kind of
a bit team of happy. Oh my goodness. Okay. Yeah. It's kind of midwinter, isn't it? And the urge to get out of the house, even though you need to, is very much not it's not happening, is
yeah.
it? It's, I just wanna
Well,
sit
it's also
in with...
there's too much. I've got loads of admin to catch up on. I've got the looming tax return.
But why do we always leave it so late? Self-employed people out there, why do we always leave it to January? And don't one lie year. If you say you do it before January.
No,
don't
one
lie.
Year, one year, I didn't. One year, I was doing, it was in this zone. I was thinking, oh God, I've got to do my tax return. And then I looked, I'd already done it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Only
oh,
once.
The joy once. Yeah. And then I went, oh, this is brilliant. I must do this every year.
I've got my company accounts to do as well. It's the whole thing. But anyway, once we're through January, it'll then just be depressing February and then it's a slide towards summer. Hurrah, hurrah.
I've got a feeling summer's going to come early. It's already, you know, there's jobs coming in, things for, you know, March and June and stuff.
It's a big year this year. We're busy.
Yeah. It's good.
It's good. And gang, if any of you are thinking of coming to London this summer, let us know. It'd be lovely to hear from you, whether or not you come and do a tour. You know, if you're coming, just let us know. We're around. We can tell you where we are. You can come and stalk us. come meet you for a coffee, whatever.
Yeah.
Mine's a gin and tonic. happy days. Well, we mentioned last week after Fiona's great chat about phone boxes and kind of the iconic street furniture of London, that I'm actually away at the moment. So this is some super meta thing. This is not me. I'm speaking from the past. I'm on holiday. I mean, it won't be a holiday. I'm in Portugal with a friend, visiting a friend. And I mean, I'm blatantly going to be working from over there, but never mind. It'll be fine. But I'm going to go somewhere that is marginally less cold than the UK. And
which
time
bit?
With some dogs. It's in the countryside,
nice.
So it's by the coast.
Okay.
So I'm going to do a little bit of swimming in the sea.
Oh,
nice. Yeah. Dog walks and things. Happy days. So hopefully, as you're listening to this, that's exactly what I'm doing. Although if you're listening in the evening, I'm probably half cut. Let's yeah. My friend who I'm going to see is not, she doesn't skimp on the booze.
Okay.
She's very generous.
Yeah.
So never shall your glass be empty.
If you're listening in Australia, then Alex is already half cut.
Yes. Especially if it's the morning.
Yeah, breakfast. That's what I was.
Exactly. Yeah. Breakfast drinking. Yeah.
So.
Right. Well, this week.
But you're chatting before you go.
Yes, I'm chatting before I go. But it's me this week, and I'm going to talk about. Now, this is someone who, if you've been on my Harlots tour, I have mentioned, and I mentioned that there's a very small link between last week and this week. Now, it's been a while for this version outing of this version of me, but we're doing sexy history again.
Whee!
Sort of sexy history. We're going back to the Georgian era for somebody who is tangentially involved in the Georgian sex trade, which is a topic that I absolutely love. I love my Harlots tour. It's so much fun. There's some really interesting stuff there, and it ruins Covent Garden for everybody, and I'm happy with that. Because everyone knows it is a place of, you know, oh, lovely shopping. And I'm like, let me tell you about all the filthy stuff that used to go on around here. It's brilliant. But I'm going to tell you about a lady who has been really interesting to me for quite some time now, a lady called Moll King. Have you heard of Moll King?
Well, I think possibly, just like a couple of weeks ago where you said Reginald Bray and I went, oh, I know. Oh, no, I don't know Reginald Bray. I think I have heard of Moll King, but I'm not sure I've heard of this one.
Right. So there are a couple and, well, two major ones. I mean, the name Moll King, you know, Moll was a very popular name in the Georgian era. In fact, her name's not Moll at all. Her name's Elizabeth.
Isn't also Moll a generic word for people in the sex trade or for
yes, for, so, people in the sex trade or sort of slightly kind of almost maybe underworldy kind of, yeah, but definitely if you were called Moll, there was a good chance that you were in some
Dutch.
Way, no, not no, Dutch, but no? in some okay. way linked to the sex trade. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, so it was quite a good way of measuring that. But her real name is Elizabeth Adkins, but we don't know her as that. We know her as Moll King. And Moll King is not a very uncommon name. You know, it's not the kind of thing where there's only going to be one in history. And in fact, there's two very close together within about 20 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, I say within 20 years, their times would have crossed over. They were born about 20 years apart.
Oh, okay.
And so sometimes the Moll King that we're going to talk about today, her story gets conflated with the story of another Moll King who seems to have been a bit of a pickpocket, a fence. Possibly the person upon whom Daniel Defoe's Moll Flanders is based as well. So some people then say it's about this Moll King, but actually it's not really.
Right.
It's the other one. Anyway, so if you read some accounts of it, it'll be like, oh, and she was this big pickpocket and she was, you know, violent and she went to court loads and got transported. No, not this one. Not this one.
Okay.
But people don't make that distinction, which is frustrating because it's not quite the same story. Anyway. So our Moll King, Elizabeth Adkins, was a very well-known member of London's Georgian era. Now, I'm not going to say society, because she definitely wasn't society at all. But what she was is she lived pretty much most of her life in and around Covent Garden.
Uh-huh.
And everybody knew her. Everyone knew Moll King. She was fascinating. She was a businesswoman, a proprietor, and sometimes a little bit law-breaking.
Right.
And definitely not somebody who you wanted to mess with. You know, she's a formidable woman. Like, I think any women in the 1700s, if you are in business, you've got to have some gumption about you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's no, you're not going to be a pushover. And Moll King certainly isn't a pushover. So like I say, there's loads of myths surrounding her. There's stories about affairs with dangerous criminals and this, that and the other. And most of that is the other Moll King, or possibly just some kind of heightened version of our Moll King.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, yeah, like I say, so there's a few of them knocking around. And the, in fact, even during her lifetime, these pickpocketing rumours came up and it was very clear. And in fact, that just after she died, there was a book written about her, or not really a book, a pamphlet, let's say.
Yeah.
And in it said, oh, no, that was completely not her. And it was literally discredited as she died, essentially. Everyone's going, no, it wasn't her at all. So who was she? Well, she was born in 1696 on Vine Street, which has since been renamed very creatively to Grape Street, which I rather like. Vine to Grape. And if anyone knows the Covent Garden area, there is a theatre called the Shaftesbury Theatre, just to the north of Covent Garden. It's where, I think, Mrs. Doubtfire's on at the moment, I think, is there. Anyway, the street that runs just behind the theatre, that's Grape Street.
Right.
So it's in the St. Giles area. St. Giles was known, as you know, Fiona, and I think we've discussed quite a few times on the podcast.
Yeah.
It's a slum area. It's not rich. It's a very poor area. Her father was a shoemaker. Her mother sold fruit and veg in Covent Garden from a barrow. And that's what Moll did as well. She actually was, I say, that's what she did. She started out in service. So going into, you know, service in a house, somebody's servant, and I don't know what exact service she was, but she found it so boring that she basically just went, nope, not doing that anymore. And she went back to Covent Garden. And, you know, her mum probably would have gone, go into service. It's a really good career. You know, you all that sort of thing. She was like, nah, stuff it. So she went back to selling from a barrow in Covent Garden.
Yep.
Which I think is quite interesting. Most people would probably go the other way.
Yeah.
But like I said this on my Harlots tour before, for women in the 1700s, there aren't that many options. If you're aristocratic or part of high society, your one job is to marry and breed. That's it. It's a stud farm. If you're in the lower echelons of society, you go into service or you're a washerwoman.
Yeah.
That's mostly it. And you will get married in that. That, you know, that will be an expectation of you. You'll probably, you might then stay at home. But, you know, the only options really were, washerwoman or service. So actually selling fruit, veg and Covent Garden is going to be a bit of a step down from the service. But if you want to do something other than those things, your choices are limited and you've really got to push for it.
Yeah.
So this is presumably what Moll King does.
It's like selling the fruit and veg, it's less secure than service, but it's a lot more on your own terms.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot more freedom to it.
Yeah.
And she would have served everybody going through there. So you're in the heart of the theatre district. You're not far from the royal area. So you've got it's a melting pot. You know, there's everybody coming in from all over the place. So she gets to know everyone who comes past. She gets to know the aristocrats, the courtesans, of which there are many, because this is Covent Garden was slap bang in the middle of what was known as the sexual superhighway, running through London, running from the city of London over to sort of into St. James's Park and that kind of way. And Covent Garden is, you know, at the heart of all of this. So you've got all your courtesans, every drunken ne'er-do-well, she's going to know their names. She'll know them all. They'll be buying fruit and veg from her. And this is going to work out very nicely for her later. So she basically creates her reputation through all of this. Now she marries the guy that she gets her name from, King, Tom King, in 1717. So she'd have been about 20, 21.
Yeah.
So this is where she takes the name King. So the name Moll, there are, and again, it's tricky to know what is true and what isn't for her and whether it's the other Moll King, but there's a chance that she probably was in prostitution at some point. You know, we don't quite know, but the name Moll is a good indication that maybe at some point, who knows. So she married Tom King, and Tom is actually from rather good breeding. He's a very different kettle of fish. He's the son of a baronet, no less.
Ooh.
And he'd gone to Eton and then King's College, Cambridge.
Okay.
And at this point, it all goes a little bit wrong. He basically either drops out or is expelled. One of the two.
Right.
But either way, he leaves under a bit of a cloud and he sort of falls from grace. So he heads to Covent Garden and, you know, kind of dumps his aristocratic, you know, background or whatever. This is where he meets Moll.
Yep.
And she seems to be a bit of a beauty. And I've read a few accounts where it pretty much says she can have her pick of the men. You know, they're all falling at her feet. And she's obviously quite charismatic as well.
Yeah.
Because she's like I say, she's got some gumption about her. So Tom falls for her. Tom is known in the area as smooth-faced Tom.
Okay.
Which I find rather entertaining.
Yes.
Now, I was trying to think what that might indicate. And I don't know if that's an indication that he's from a sort of an aristocratic background or higher society.
Untouched by weather, kind of, you know, indoors. Or is it just that he's not growing a beard? He's kind of youthful and...
Exactly. I'm not quite sure. I've only ever just read that description of him, but never been, you know, found a physical description of him.
Yeah. Okay.
Smoothed faced. So I don't know whether,
Well, that also...
Whether it was about shaving and...
It kind of suggests, I mean, this is, if you take it as not a physical description, it suggests someone who's kind of, like, honest faced to me. Like, he's like either a kind of smooth talker or... You know, that they're kind of good at smoothing their way through, maybe.
Might have been a bit of a charmer.
Yeah, I mean, charmer. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, so I don't quite know what to take from that, but definitely he sticks out, you know, enough to give himself a nickname. And I imagine him almost as this like kind of cherubic looking aristocratic guy who doesn't quite fit in, but also does, because he's sort of eschewing all of that. And, and he's also a raging alcoholic. So he's that smooth face is going to last for very long. Anyway, they have a kid. They have a son called Charles, and he's their only child. He's named in Moll's will, actually. And there are stories, too, that he was educated at Eton, but there's no evidence of that. And I don't really know how they would have afforded that.
Uh-huh.
And it's probably that his dad's sort of educational history is kind of being shoved onto him, if you like.
Yeah.
And people are extrapolating.
Yeah.
We don't know. I don't really know too much about Charles, to be honest.
Eton might have been less expensive back then as well, maybe.
But it still would have been very incredibly expensive for a couple who are living and working on Covent Garden, because when they get together, in fact, they get together, break up, and then they get back together again. When they get back together, they start a stall selling nuts.
Okay.
So that's not going to be, you know,
raking
the
in
largest
the cash.
Income.
No.
But it's clearly doing very well for them, because very shortly afterwards, they can afford to rent a premises from the Duke of Bedford at £12 a year.
Oh, okay.
Now, I did look at the conversion for this, and the £12 a year seems to equate to about £2.5k a year, which isn't a huge amount in today's money.
No.
But it was little more than a shack. I mean, if you think about Covent Garden Piazza now, the Duke of Bedford laid it out. But the way that we have it, with the lovely market, with the roof in the middle, these beautiful houses around the outside, it wasn't like that in the 1700s. It was, yes, you had your market in the middle, but it wasn't a permanent building. And around the edges, it was kind of lean-tos and shacks and almost like kind of pop-up things. And it's not until the 1800s, is it, where the Bedfords decide they're going to, you know, knock it all down, build these amazing houses, and then, you know, sell them off for tons of money.
Yeah.
So at the time, it would have been very kind of low rise and very, sort of higgledy-piggledy, really. So they rent this shack from him, but it does the job. And they create Tom King's Coffee House.
Uh-huh.
Now, obviously, it's got Tom King's name on it. Like I say, he's an alcoholic, and pretty much Moll takes over the running of it, and she is brilliant at it. It's a roaring success. They start to sell coffee, tea, chocolate to anyone and everyone. And because they're so well known in the area, Moll knows everybody from her time working on the Barrows, which she'd have done from a very, very young age. Tom's got a lot of high status contacts who are, you know, waffling through the place. It becomes incredibly popular, and it starts to be known as King's College, which I rather like.
Yes.
No relation to the university at all.
No, no.
But because you get all of these big, you know, big names. I mean, we've got people like Henry Fielding, Alexander Pope, William Hogarth.
Yeah.
A lot of the kind of big minds, big thinkers of the day, they're going there. And when they start to serve booze as well, this just increases their reputation. So King's College, you know, people are going there and discussing.
And also, don't the, like the coffee houses generally, some of them are known as penny universities. So it's a kind of equivalent of that. So that's lovely.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's the sort of place where people can congregate and talk things over. And especially in that area, like I say, you know, you're in the middle of Theatre Lounge, you're in the middle of Westminster, you've got the royal and the political powerhouse, you've got a lot of people with influence, and you've got a lot of creativity there, you've got a lot of big minds who want to get together and chat about stuff, and so that's what they do. So they start selling booze, and then they start opening in the small hours. Now think about it as a market. You've got the market traders who will be there from the small hours starting to trade. And so they open to take advantage of that business there. And then very quickly, they pretty much go 24 hours.
Okay.
So, you know, it's running most of the day and night. And like I say, Tom's an alcoholic. So Moll, she doesn't drink at all. She runs the place. She stays sober to keep an eye on things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she may have drunk a bit, but she stays sober. She keeps an eye on it. She's, you know, turning away the tricksy ones. She's stopping fights, because you could get into a lot of trouble if you were running a place that was, you know, rowdy and people are falling out of the place drunk.
Yeah,
you can get into quite a bit of trouble.
Yeah.
And she served anyone and everyone, from the road sweepers to, interestingly, King George the Second. Now, King George the Second, as far as I'm aware, I don't know how many times he went, but as far as I'm aware, there's definitely one time that we know of, because it's quite an entertaining time. He turns up at Tom King's coffee house, sits down, starts drinking whatever he's drinking, and then he basically starts making eyes at somebody's girl that someone's with. Ooh. Now, the King George II, he was a little bit of a player, you know, whatever. But he starts making eyes at somebody. The guy who is with this girl doesn't recognise the king and basically asks him outside for a fight. So the king scarpers, he leaves, which is probably in your best interests for self-preservation to do that. Anyway, and there's a little little paragraph I want to read you from a kind of a report of the time, which talks about the people going to the coffee house. It says, as night waned, the company that drifted in became extremely various. Noblemen and the first beau, as in, you know, the handsome fop type things, after leaving court, would go to Moll King's in full dress with swords and bags in rich brocaded silk coats, so that the chimney sweeper, the pickpocket, the maudlin peer, were often to be seen in the same seat together. At dawn, over the heads of the market women, a drunken young dandy might be observed riding home on the roof of his sedan chair. I think it's fantastic. And it's so popular that Henry Fielding even says of it, he says, what rake is ignorant of King's Coffee House? So everyone knows it. It's, you know, one of the, there's a couple of coffee houses. The Bedford Coffee House is another big one on Covent Garden Piazza. So important that it actually writes its own, to lots of its own sort of accounts, memories, if you like. But King's is up there as one of
three or four that are. Of the West End ones, that's one of the ones. I don't know a lot about it, but it's the one I've heard bits about, kind of. Yeah, it's definitely,
And it grew. They were so popular that it grew. You had the long room, which was the main space, and then there were two smaller spaces that were used for kind of gambling and like little parties and things like that. And inside, it was decorated to very much whet the appetite for the sort of thing that might be in the area.
Oh, I say.
The kind of extracurricular fun that you might be able to find around. Over the fireplace,
do we know where it was, presumably?
There is a painting that Hogarth did of it. Hogarth, that notorious fun sponge. I think I've mentioned him before. He is a fun sponge though, isn't he? Come on. He moralises about everything, and you see people going out and having fun with gin or whatever, and he starts going, and writing drawing a picture to sort of ward you off all the fun stuff. And he must have been a hoot at parties.
And then there was his dad who opened a coffee shop where you had to speak Latin.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, there you go. That tells you everything you need to know about Hogarth. I can imagine. Non-successorum or whatever. What was I saying? So in this painting by Hogarth, or etching, whatever you want to call it, he did a series of four, and it was called something like The Four Times of the Day. And you know how he did these series where you go through stuff. And so it was the four times of the day: morning, noon, afternoon, and evening, I think, or something like that. The morning one, he had Tom King's coffee house in it, but he's moved it.
Okay.
He put it in front of St. Paul's Church on Covent Garden because it looked nicer. But actually, it was on the southern side. From what I've looked at, I believe it was around where the Ivy is today, where the kind of Pizza Hut used to be.
Okay. Oh, yes.
So at the top of Southampton Street.
Yeah.
It might have been a little bit further over towards where the London Transport Museum is.
Okay.
But somewhere along that side. I believe it was kind of where the Ivy where the Ivy is today.
Yes. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you just as you were about to tell us about the exciting decoration.
Yes.
Much more interesting. Go back to the decoration.
So the exciting decoration, oh my goodness. So one of the pieces that I know was in there over the fireplace was an image of a monk and a nun engaging in what I'm going to refer to as slightly less than Christian behaviour. It was particularly obscene.
Okay.
So that's fun. Yeah. So you can basically go in there and be like, well, hey. Now, I should say, you know, so all of these revelers, these late night revelers who are coming in and having a great old time, it is not, You can imagine that it's not a great leap to go from this sort of 24-hour coffee house, boozery, all this sort of stuff, to a brothel.
Right.
There are so many brothels in the area. It's what the area is known for. But they don't do this. Moll King decides absolutely not. She's very aware. So brothels were technically illegal.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many, and they were often, as long as you were respectable in terms of, you know, you're not kind of, haven't got loads of drunken patrons falling out to the street and causing noise and all this sort of stuff. If you went pretty much under the radar, you'd mostly be okay. Because bear in mind, a lot of the people who are visiting these brothels are the same magistrates and police who are going to be having you up on charges. So you got a bit of wiggle room often. What you did find is there were quite a lot of sort of evangelical reforming societies who would go around and honey trap or send in informants and try and kind of catch you out at stuff. And then try and get you basically brought up on a charge of some description. Now, Mole's very aware of this, and she is, of course, on Covent Garden Piazza. If you're off down a little side street and you've got a discreet brothel, you're probably a bit better off. And Mole's like, I'm on the piazza. It's pretty crazy. It was, there were, you know, fights were known to spill out, all this sort of stuff. If she didn't have a brothel there, they couldn't get her on anything.
Yes, that sounds good.
They did try. These reforming societies did send in spies, informants, trying to get her on something, and they couldn't really. A little bit later, she is brought up on charges of, causing a nuisance with some fights and stuff. We'll come to that. But one of the things that she saw is this loophole of, look, I'm not going to be a brothel, but I'm going to help people find what they want. They didn't have any beds there at all. They did have one bed, and it was their bed, Tom and Mole's bed.
Yeah.
And where it was upstairs in the kind of attic. And the only way you can access it was by pulling down with a rope, pulling a trapdoor down to get into it.
Right.
And so she hid it essentially from her patrons so that nobody could use it.
Then
she wasn't in hot water for anything.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good. But there were plenty of brothels nearby. So lots of the working girls would go and have coffees in there, in the coffee shop. So they're around.
Yeah.
And there were actually ways you could tell how one of the girls was available for hire.
Right.
And I'm going to tell you that after the short break. Okay, so we are back on Mole King's Coffee House in Covent Garden. So I was talking about how she was getting, there was this loophole where she was amazingly able to, you know, not get arrested for being a brothel. But the girls would be at the coffee house, and there was a way that you could spot a sex worker who was available. The girls would go and they would sip a milky coffee called a cappuccino.
Oh, okay.
I wonder where we get this from. And it's a coffee that's cut with cream. Basically, it's you know, the coffee was quite thick and sludgy and quite grim. And especially if you're nursing something for a while, you know, you want it to be a larger drink than just a small coffee. So they'd cut it with cream, and they would sit there. And sipping a cappuccino would mean that you were available for hire, basically. So think about that next time you go to Cafe Nero.
Yes.
Having a nice cappuccino from Starbucks, and just think about the message you're putting out there. Anyway, so if your punters, if they wanted somebody in particular or something that wasn't available at the coffee house, then she could help source one of the girls, and the servants would then take them off to a nearby establishment with beds for hire. And of course, you know, Mole King would get a cut and all this stuff. So she's making business out of it without making business.
Absolutely.
So, very clever.
Yeah.
Yeah. She can't be charged with running a brothel or a bawdy house.
Yeah.
But it was referred to by, I think, Hogarth as a place that was open to all gentlemen to whom beds were unknown. So basically, if you, you know, needed a bed for your exploits, she'd sort you out.
She'd find,
essentially.
Yeah.
And like I say, reforming... Sorry, did you have a question?
No. I was just being slowly catching up.
He's breathing heavily.
Yeah.
You don't want to do that during this one. So, I mentioned there's these reforming societies, and they keep trying to pull her up on something, and it's not happening. But they are a bit worried that they're going to get caught for something, so they developed their own language, and it was called Talking Flash.
Okay.
Now I have tried, because we have talked about the Caravan Club before,
yeah,
and that there was a language that was invented to, again, be able to talk so that the police couldn't understand you.
Okay.
This is the same thing. So, yeah, it was called Talking Flash, and I've not been able to find any examples of it. There does seem to be one very weighty academic document, which I cannot get access to, and would probably be far more than I ever needed to read. But basically, it was a form where anybody listening in who doesn't speak it is going to be incomprehensible.
Yeah.
It was a bit similar. There was another language or what they refer to as a cant that was used by thieves to avoid capture, and that goes back to 1400s.
Oh, okay.
It's the same sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Even, I mean,
develop your own language.
Cockney rhyming slang seems like same kind of, yeah. So
absolutely.
There must have been so many different, like, almost dialects around London.
Yeah.
Then.
Would have been wonderful, wouldn't it, just to listen in and be like, oh, this is amazing.
And it'd be so amazing to walk down the street and be like listening to you and think, it sounds like it's English, but I don't know what they're saying. It'd be weird. Yeah.
Which, if you get someone with a really thick accent of whatever sort, it can be a bit like that anyway.
Yeah.
But it's quite nice to listen to. I want to go back to the Hogarth picture briefly, actually. So I mentioned that he features this coffee shop in the morning, one of the four times a day. And on it, and again, we'll put a picture up on the blog and probably on social media as well. There's a woman in her finery. She's walking past the front of the coffee house. You've got St. Paul's Church. So this is not St. Paul's Cathedral, I should add, for people who don't know London that well. St. Paul's Church, known as the Actors' Church. Beautiful, beautiful place, right on Covent Garden Piazza. If you've been, it's where often there's lots of street performers at the front of it, underneath the columns.
Yeah, big columns, portico. It doesn't really look like a church, does it? It looks like a sort of arch.
Yeah, it was like a theatre space, natural kind of theatre space. Anyway, so they've got St. Paul's in the background, and then they've got Tom King's Coffee House in front. And you can see just inside the door of the coffee house, there's a massive brawl going on.
Okay.
And then outside, there's snow on the roof as well, with icicles hanging off it too. Mm-hmm. So in front, the very front part of the picture, there's a little child, I think it's a girl, with a fire, just warming her hands on the fire. And behind her are two young rakes.
Right.
And they've tumbled out onto the street with their prostitutes of the day. And they've just sort of tumbled out and they're, busy necking before heading off and doing whatever. So that is Hogarth's interpretation of Moll King's Coffee House.
Yes.
Which may or may not be 100% accurate. I don't know. It sounds pretty...
Sounds plausible from what you said.
Apart from location.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds plausible, definitely. Now, one thing I really like about Moll King is that she has visions of grandeur
for
herself. She has always dreamt of owning a large house in the countryside. And she was going the right way about it. The coffee shop was doing so well that in the end, she actually got it. Tom was able to build a couple of large houses in Haverstock Hill near Chalk Farm. Now, today, that's what we would class as pretty central. But back in the day, that was countryside. Yeah, and it became known as Moll King's Folly, which I rather like.
Okay, yeah.
They were built in 1739, and Tom King died in the same year.
Right.
So his drinking got the better of him, and over he goes. He's buried in St. Paul's Churchyard in Covent Garden.
Okay.
Which I rather like.
Yeah.
Now, Moll then actually does turn to drink, and I don't know if we can read too much into that, or if it was just the case of she stayed sober because her husband was such a drunkard that she needed to, or maybe she was depressed. I mean, we don't know.
Yeah.
But she starts to drink and things start to get a bit rowdier at the coffee shop. She keeps it going though. It still bears his name. It's theoretically known as Moll King's Coffee House. It's now just referred to as King's Coffee House. And there are a few stories that she would try to rip patrons off a little bit.
Ooh.
If they were really drunk, she'd scatter broken crockery around their table and then be like, you broke this, and charge them for the damage and just sort of assume they're going to be too drunk to notice, which I think is very enterprising, if not entirely above board.
Yeah.
And pretty much a year, almost exactly, after her husband dies, Moll marries again. She keeps her name of King. There's definitely,
it's a good brand by then.
It's good branding, yeah, exactly. She marries a guy called John Hoff, and there's a little bit of speculation that he's after her money. There's not any real evidence of that.
Okay.
Because he dies only 4 months later and leaves her everything.
Okay. So maybe the other way around, if anything. I mean, no.
Maybe the other way around, potentially. Well, I mean, she's doing well for herself. Yeah. He's also in St. Paul's Church.
Uh-huh.
He's buried there too. But what is interesting is that Moll enacts the will. He leaves everything to her. She's the only person. But she enacts the will before he's even buried.
Oh, okay.
So make of that what you will. But she's definitely...
Was it a big legacy, do we know? Or...
I don't think it was small. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't think it was... I haven't read anywhere that it was enormous. Yeah. she left a big fortune when she died, but most of that, I would hazard a guess, was her own work.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but it was definitely nothing. It was definitely wasn't nothing.
Okay.
But I have to say, I've not been able to find any exact details about how well she did out of that. And a couple of months after he died, there's a disturbance that gets into the newspapers at King's Coffee House. There's a young gentleman brings her, well, brings the case up to the Court of the King's Bench, and he says that Moll has beaten him inside her coffee house. And she was told, for this, you're going to be fined £200.
Oh, okay. That which is hefty.
A significant amount of money. Yeah. And she had to promise that she was basically going to behave in the future, and she's going to be held in prison until the fine is paid. And Moll could have paid it.
Okay.
She could have paid it. And she was like, I'm not paying it. And she goes to prison. And she says, and I absolutely love this. She goes, and I'm going to do a really dodgy Cockney accent now. If I was to pay £200 to all the insolent boys I had thrashed for their impudence, the Bank of England would be unable to furnish me with the cash. So she's basically saying, yeah, of course.
Of course I thrashed
him. He came into my coffee shop. He was a nightmare. And I gave him a walloping.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I? I do that all the time, which is brilliant. Prison doesn't seem to really have fazed her too much. Her nephew runs the coffee shop in her absence, and she hangs out in prison, seemingly able to bribe the guards quite a lot for lots of home comforts and things.
Okay.
Which I think is rather fun. They may well have been people she knew.
Yeah.
It's all local.
Yeah.
You know.
Do we know which prison?
I'm not 100% sure.
No, but I mean,
there were quite a lot around the area. So. Yeah.
And they were quite different to modern prisons as well, so let's say it might not have been a
and essentially she was just like, oh, I'm not paying £200.
so eventually she
kind of bartered them down, and she ended up paying £50.
Oh, well, that's
so a quarter, which is pretty good. I don't know how she managed to do that, but gift of the gab, people in high places, who knows? And then eventually she gave it all up and she retired to her lovely house in North London. And when she made her will, she does refer to herself as Moll Hoff. So her second husband's name, of the parish of St. Paul's, Covent Garden. And her will said, everything that I own is being left to my son, only child. But it has to be kept in trust for him until he reaches 30. And if he doesn't reach 30, my entire estate is to be given to help the poor children of the Covent Garden area. Now, I have to say, I don't know what happened to her son.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether he got the pretty sizable fortune.
Yeah.
Or whether it was... But I love that, you know, she came from really poor, a poor family in Covent Garden. And girl come good.
Yeah.
And, very interesting. And there's... It does seem that the Georgian sex trade, whether... So one of the figures that I often quote is that one in five women at the time was either directly or tangentially involved in the sex trade in London in that era.
And let's just clarify, we're not talking one in five women in Covent Garden, are we? We're talking
in London, whole of London.
At
some point in their lives, whether or not, you know, their entire life at some point, but one in five. And it was, as I said earlier, you know, one of the only options where you had relative freedom, which is quite interesting. And there's a significant seam of women who do very, very well out of it. Often, you know, starting out as a sex worker themselves and then going on to be a bawd, which is someone who owns a bawdy house, basically owns a brothel.
Yeah.
And they were often known as mother something or other. There's quite a few sort of famous mother Douglas and people like that who were very famous.
And I get the impression very shrewd business ladies.
Oh yeah.
All of them. Kind of.
Very shrewd on a variety of different formats.
Yep.
both health of their girls and you know, the company that they would allow into the houses and, you know, all sorts of stuff. I mean, I could go on for this for hours. I find it a fascinating topic. But, you know, there's mothers or boards who very much put a lot of effort into keeping their girls healthy and into contraception, early and rudimentary as it is, and things like that. So, and there are others, of course. You know, there's the little book that I think I've spoken about before. It caters for everybody and everything.
Yeah.
And of course, the pox is a big thing in the time. So, you know, syphilis. So if you have the pox, you're going to want to find a girl who has already got the pox. You don't really want to spread it around too much. So there's catering for everything, you know.
Yeah, just finding your market. Yeah. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And Moll would have known who and where.
Yeah.
So she would have been, yeah, right at the forefront of it all.
Yeah.
She'd have known.
Wow.
And
it is so such a different feeling about Covent Garden than, like you said right at the beginning, that than yeah. we kind of get nowadays strolling through.
Yeah. Quite she, you know, well-heeled area. It's not that at
no.
all. Now, she dies in 1747. And okay. very shortly after, I mean, literally within a matter of months, in the same year, there's a pamphlet
published. Oh, it is quite tough.
Thank you.
A pamphlet, isn't it? Pamphlet published.
pamphlet was published. There we go. So pamphlet. And it was called...
That's not a word anymore. Title. Sorry, but you say it often enough. It's pamphlet. That's no way. Is that
pamphlet
a word?
It's not a word. No, it doesn't exist. It's not a thing. But the pamphlet is called The Life and Character of Moll King, Late Mistress of King's Coffee House in Covent Garden, published anonymously in 1747, shortly after her death. And that's the name of the thing. And it is anonymous, but it is said to be by one of her regular patrons.
Okay.
And I'm just going to read the sort of intro or I guess like the synopsis for it.
Yeah.
So that's the title of it. And then this is the synopsis that comes after it, containing a true narrative of this well-known lady from her birth to her death, wherein is inserted several humorous adventures relating to persons of both sexes who were fond of nocturnal revels. Ooh. Also, the flash dialogue between Moll King and old gentleman Harry that was some years ago murdered in Covent Garden, and the pictures of several noted family men drawn to the life. To the whole is added an epitaph and elegy wrote by one of Moll's favourite customers and a key to the flash dialogue.
Ah.
Now, you're going to ask who old gentleman Harry is who got murdered. Can I find anything about him? Can I Eckers-like? No.
No.
I've done a bit of digging. I'm probably going to have to go deep into some archives if I want to find out, but he does sound good.
Yeah. Do we have the rest of the pamphlet, or we just have that title page surviving?
I'm sure there's a pamphlet somewhere.
Because that would have the flash dictionary thing.
It might be a Kew Archives number. Yeah. I might have to go and have a bit of a rummage in Kew Archives at some point. Yeah, so I think that's really fascinating, and I in that pamphlet they throw out the questions of her being a pickpocket and offence and all this sort of stuff, and in it they basically say no, that you got the wrong one, you know. So I'm going to take what that pamphlet is saying, because clearly it was written by somebody who knows her, knew her very well, and wanted to pay tribute to her. Which I think is lovely. And she's also buried in St. Paul's in Covent Garden as well. Which I think is nice.
What's the arrangement between the three of them?
I don't know what the geographical arrangement is. I think we need to do a little bit of a visit maybe to the church and see if we can't find out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which would be rather fun. Yeah. So there we go. So that's Moll King. I just find her really interesting. I think I'm always fascinated by these women who go out there and you know, fight against the odds. And I just think I would have loved to have met her.
Yeah. You know? And that whole thing that like her story kind of opens a door to another world, which geographically, same place it is now, but, a few hundred years ago.
Whole different.
So different.
Yeah. And I should say, at some point this year, I am going to be running some more tours. I am going to be doing my Harlot store again. So if you do want to come and do that, I'll probably run some over the summer because it's one of my favourites. I think it's fascinating. And I read from the little book, the Covent Garden book. What's it called? I've forgotten
now. Covent Garden Ladies.
Covent Garden Ladies.
Harris's
List. Thank you very much.
That's the one
we... I haven't done it in about a year. It's a really interesting kind of who's who in yellow pages of many of your options in and around Covent Garden should you be on the hunt for a little bit of slap and tickle.
Well, what's not to like?
I say it's not a walk for the under 18s, I'll tell you that now.
Some
of those descriptions are incredibly graphic.
Yes. Yeah. But is there also a kind of grim, like, I'm presumably, I mean... some people were doing this very willingly, maybe some people not so much, mm-hmm. presumably. So
it runs the gamut. It definitely does. Yeah. I would say I err on the lighter side of it. I talk about mm-hmm. it from a position of, well, kind of similar to today, really, sort of choice and options. Yeah. And of course, there are darker sides to it. And there's a side of the industry involving children as well, which is pretty grisly. But I don't really go into that because that's not sort of focus of it. But I talk about how it empowered lots of women and how London developed. And fun fact, most of Marylebone built off the backs of the sex trade. They wouldn't want you to know that today, but there we go.
No.
So yeah, we head up into Soho and we look at a variety of different places and talk about a whole heap of different people who are really interesting. And we cover things like, you know, contraception and mm-hmm. sexual health and how that was dealt with and all that kind of thing. So yeah, I really like it. It's fun.
Yeah.
But not for the faint of heart if you are easily squeamish about all things a little bit sexy. It's maybe not one for you, but I think it's a lot of fun. And
it sounds like a barrel of I've got this wrong now for whatever reason. I'm sounding like I'm insincere saying this, but I'm not. It wasn't meant to be sarcastic. Barrel of laughs is what I was gaming for. It came out wrong.
Okay, whatever. I'll take you at your word. I'll believe you. Thousands wouldn't. Well, there we go. So yeah, that's Mel King, and I do mention her on my walk because we do go to where I believe her coffee house was.
Fabulous. Yes. Right. Well, come folks, come to London in the summer and come on the Harlot's Walk with Alex. It is a barrel of laughs, I'm gonna say.
And Fiona might have to come along as well.
Yes,
we'll drag her along.
I will happily come. Well, I was gonna say surely in Covent Garden there'd be someone who specializes in dragging people as well. In amongst the birching and the flogging and the other things you can find in Covent. Dragging would absolutely be something that someone wants. So, anyway.
Whatever your proclivities may be, there is something there for you.
Yes.
Without a shadow of a doubt. Right, well, that's it for this week. Thank you all for coming along.
I hope you're having a lovely time in Portugal.
And so do I.
Also, wherever you are, listeners, hopefully we're all having a lovely week, whatever we're doing.
Powering through January.
Yes.
Nice and strong.
And we'll see you next week. Hear you. Listen. No, absolutely. You'll hear us.
We'll be back next week.
That's the one.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.